As you know, this weekend we're going to get into some Old Testament. Figured there's been enough grace taught around here for a while. A little law. Now we're going to get into the book of Joshua and Judges, as you know. The elders, when we went away on our retreat and kind of discussed where the church was at, we really felt like the principles and some of the truths that are brought forward in those books really could be helpful for where our fellowship and where a lot of our home churches are at right now. So we're going to be going through that tonight, tomorrow. I'm going to start out tonight with the crossing of the Jordan, talk about that for a while, and then tomorrow morning, Dennis is going to get into a comparison of Jericho and Ai, and talk about principles of spiritual victory. And Jim Leffel is going to come and talk about the settlement of the land, the division of the tribes, and talk about God's sovereignty, and he has some really cool insights, I think, on God's sovereignty and our role in the body of Christ. And then tomorrow night, Gary's going to come out and teach a little bit about Caleb and his life. So it should be very good, very good. It's great to come together as fellow workers, all committed to the Lord's work here with the new folks that are with us. And also, I was noticing as I came in here, there's a handful of people, too, who are going to be leaving us this year, go out onto the mission field. And so it's great to have them with us here this weekend, too. We're going to be praying for them, too. So. Very cool. Let's talk to God for a little bit here before we get started. Lord, we do want to turn to you as a group here. Before we open the Word and study, we ask, of course, that you'd be here with us. But we're so thankful. It seems like just yesterday we were at the last Servant Team retreat. And here we sit here tonight and a whole another year of ministry has passed by. There's a lot of people who are saved now who weren't a year ago. There's people who have committed to becoming disciples that weren't there last year. There's people who have been raised up to the point where they're now on the servant team when they weren't last year. There's a lot of great things that have happened in this past year, and we give you all the credit for that. We know that that stuff would not happen given our flesh and the opposition we face in this spiritual battle. The fact that this church is doing amazingly well and moving forward, we're just so thankful for that. Thankful that you're using us. We're thankful, too, that you've placed us as leaders in this church, which is really, I think, one of the most unique churches in the world, Lord. And it says that you've placed each of us in the body of Christ just as you desired. And you've given each one of us a really significant role in this church. And I know that there are pastors out there who would kill to have just a handful of workers that have the training, the experience that we have hundreds of in this room, and we're so blessed. Pray that that's one thing we're really struck by this weekend, Lord, is how blessed we are individually and as a church, and that you would just create an attitude of thankfulness in our hearts also. So we're here this weekend to get our marching orders for the next year and to place ourselves in your hands. Pray that you would speak to us. Again, individually, but also as leaders of others, as shepherds, that you'd speak to us about what you would have us do. And we're going to listen, Lord, in your name. Amen. All right, Joshua chapter 3, the crossing of the Jordan. Let me just say at the outset, I'm giving this teaching tonight on the assumption that there's many of us here who are facing crucial struggles in our walks with God, possibly in our lives right now. That many of us have been brought to a point by the Lord where he is asking us to make a decision. You know, we always face decisions in our walk with God. Sometimes it's a struggle to find out what his will is in a certain area. Maybe we're not sure. That's not the kind of decision I'm talking about tonight. I'm talking about where we know what the will of the Lord is. He wants us to go forward. We know that. And yet, we stand there on the brink of that decision, hesitating, wondering. And, you know, this comes in a variety of forms. Maybe you're somebody who is being called on to step up into leadership for the first time. You've never led before. You've always watched other people do it. Other people handle the teaching, set the direction, deal with the issues, have the discernment to know what's going on. But now it's your turn. And God's calling on you to step forward. Maybe there is a festering issue in your home group that's been there, and you know God wants it dealt with, and he's calling on you to step forward and to play a part in that, to enter the fray of his will For some of us, maybe it's to take a stand in our marriage. For some of us, maybe it's an indwelling sin that's been there that brings us a lot of shame, and we know the Lord is calling on us to move forward with this. We find that as disciples of Christ, God periodically brings us to these points and calls on us for a decision. He will do that. He's not shy about doing that. So I was reflecting on these things. I thought of about a handful of points in my walk with God where He called on me to make a decision. The decision is clear. It's just like we're going to be studying. It's like He brings us to the Jordan River and asks us to cross over. And so the Israelites for us here are a great example. They're not always great examples, are they? But in this case, they are. And I think there's a lot of things we can really learn by seeing what happened here and the step of faith that they took. Because, again, we know what that's like. You stand there, and frankly, we feel paralyzed at the thought of moving forward and entering the thick of things. But at the same time, we feel under conviction. We don't feel right about shrinking back and clinging to the old ways. What do we do as we stand there? That's the question we're going to look at tonight. So you can call the... I got three principles. You can call them principles of faith, principles of spiritual victory, whatever you want to call them. But what we're talking about is, what do I do as I stand there? Again, paralyzed at the thought of moving forward in my individual life, but also we'll find that God will often bring our cell groups, our home churches to this point where we have to come together and decide, what are we going to be about? Even in a ministry house, I remember that was the case. I remember specifically one time in a house I was living in where we came to the realization that there was just intense bitterness festering beneath the surface that was not being dealt with. People were not close. We started realizing no one was reaching out. We had no outreach going on at all. It was a miserable situation. And as we sat around at a house meeting one night looking at each other, we realized, this is it. We have to decide together. Is this going to be a ministry house where we're helping disciple each other, or is this just going to be a living situation? It was clear what God's will was, but He was calling on us to step forward. Well, again, I think a lot of us are at that point in one way or another in our lives. And if you're not, it's okay. You will be. You will be soon. God will bring you there. And so I think it's going to be good for us to look at this and to study what happened here at the Jordan River for a little bit. So let's start. Joshua 3, verse 1. It says there that then Joshua rose early in the morning, and he and all the sons of Israel set out from Shittim. And I'll refrain from the juvenile jokes. It's tough, but I'll do it. And they came to the Jordan, and they lodged there before they crossed. It came about at the end of 3 days that the officers went through the midst of the camp. And they commanded the people, saying, when you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God with the Levitical priests carrying it, then you shall set out from your place and go after it. However, there shall be between you and it a distance of about 2,000 cubits by measure. Do not come near it, that you may know the way by which you shall go, for you have not passed this way before. Then Joshua said to the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. And so here we find the first principle we want to talk about. Consecrate yourselves. The first step, the first thing to consider as we stand there is really an inward step that we take. Something that goes on in our hearts and in our minds, and that is this idea of consecration. That we consecrate ourselves. Do you know what it means to consecrate yourself? Have you ever consecrated yourself to a task? It means simply to set yourself apart. It means set apart or devoted to God. That this is devoted to God. It's put in His hands for His work. To accomplish His purpose, whatever that may be. We're asked to consecrate ourselves, to put our lives in God's hands. To use as He sees fit. And so here, the nation, after 40 years, remember, of wandering in the wilderness... Here they are brought to the banks of the Jordan, brought to the edge of the Promised Land. It says that they rest there for 3 days, and then Joshua sends his officers out to circulate amongst the people, calling out, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do amazing things. Consecrate yourselves, he says. calls for consecration. Why? Well, let's think about their situation. And remember, these are people just like you and I in most ways. This is not fable. It's easy to just read it in kind of that upper story mentality, as Francis Schaeffer used to say. These were real people. And as they stood there on the banks of the Jordan looking down across the valley, one thing they noticed was the city of Jericho. Possibly from where they were, they might have even been able to see it. God could have had them cross at a lot of different places, and yet he has them cross right opposite Jericho, a place that was like entering a beehive. Jericho out there with its armaments glistening in the sun. Possibly they could hear the armor rattling and the war cries because they knew they were coming. And God sends them right into the teeth of the enemy. Right at him. There was other places they could have crossed that wouldn't have made much of a stir. And certainly there's a strategic reason why they were crossing here, to divide the enemy in half. But he sends them right into the teeth of the enemy. That's where they were headed tomorrow. Not only that, but as the report of the spies at Kadesh Barnea revealed, these were rough dudes in the land of Canaan. There's giants, warriors, experienced in warfare, hardened in battle, cities that were built to withstand incredible attack. This was a tough place. They were not just going to roll over. And of course, there's no escape. Such an important point. They had a word from the Lord that as they move forward, the waters of the Jordan would open up before them. They did not have a word from the Lord that if things didn't work out, they would open up again to let them back. They didn't. Once they crossed, that was it. And so if nothing else, the account of the crossing of the Jordan is a story of commitment. Full commitment to the Lord. Because once they went over, the cost of turning their backs at that point was way too high. That wasn't an option. That wasn't an option. This is partially why Joshua is having them consecrate themselves. Think about this first. Like in the movies, when the guy walks into the room and the steel door closes behind him. That's the situation they were in. Once they crossed, it was all or nothing. There was no escape. And also we find that soon after they would cross over, God was not going to provide food anymore for them. They were on their own. They were going to have to raise their own food. The manna wasn't going to fall out of the sky anymore. And these were people who had grown up in the desert. They weren't good farmers. They didn't know what to do. So this is the situation that they're looking at on the banks of the Jordan that day. That's fearsome. And so when God brings us to that point, there is real fear and there's real risk involved. It's real danger. And this is why Joshua asked them to consider the cost. Don't take this decision lightly. Think about this and consecrate yourselves. There's no going back. See, it's either forward into the promised land, forward to the new that God has for you, or retreat into the old. And you know, there was no guarantee that they were going to go forward. They failed 40 years earlier. This was such a crucial moment. They could have done that again. Who knows what would have happened? 40 more years? Let another generation pass? Maybe. It's a crucial moment that God is calling on. And so consecration then, I think it's good to think of it this way. It's an act of looking at my view of the situation. As frightening as it is, as daunting as it is to enter the fray of the situation that God has before me, to look at that and then to compare that with God's view of that same situation and what he's calling on me to do. And so in consecration, there is an amount of wrestling that goes on. We wrestle with our fears, with our view of the situation, with our will. We wrestle to the point where we start to come around and see God's perspective on it, and eventually we wholeheartedly agree with God that his way is best. At that point, we could say we have consecrated ourselves to that task. I remember once some leaders asked me to get involved in a situation with some brothers and sisters who were conflicted in a very intense fight with each other. And some leaders asked me to go in and mediate and try to help them work through that. I did not want to do that at all. That just churned my stomach to think of that because, you know, I just don't feel confident in that situation. I knew what was going on. I hate intense situations like that. And I don't feel like I think quickly on my feet that I can discern what's going on in those kind of situations. I get flustered. And also there is a fear that I was going to get tangled up in it too. That I was going to get hurt. And that was a real possibility. So, you know, this really bugged me. And so as I thought about it, you know, of course, then all the other thoughts come up. Well, these leaders are asking me to do it because they don't want to do it. They're just shoving it on me. And furthermore, I'm so busy. I've got so much stress on me right now. I can't believe they're putting this on too. They don't understand. And all these thoughts. That was my perception of it. And I remember walking down Kelso Road one night, praying. I talked to God about this. And gradually, the idea of the sovereignty of God began to dawn on me. It's not my place to judge the motives of those other leaders. I don't know what their motives were. Even if they were bad, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. What concerns me is that God has placed this before me. God has placed this before me. And we've got to make room for the sovereignty of God in our lives. That these just aren't mistakes, bad circumstances that we're stumbling into. And as I thought about that, I realized, you know, okay, if Jesus Christ were in my shoes in this situation, do I believe that he could go in there and handle that? Do I think he could work through that? I really believe he could. Based on what I know, I really believe he could help them. And we can say that and just, you know, be saying the Christian thing. But I really could see, you know, Christ could handle this. And I've got the Spirit of Christ within me. He indwells me. He wants me to depend on him. I want to see him do that. And gradually, I started to get a little bit excited about the fact that I could see something supernatural happen here. And even some insights started coming. I wonder if they thought about this. The fears didn't go away. No. Fear was still there. But gradually, a sense of, I see what God might want to have happen here, and maybe he can use me to do that. And so I remember going back to the leaders and saying, I'll do it. That's what consecration is like. It's a wrestling that we go through. And this decision comes our way, where we have a decision of whether or not we want to enter the fray in all these different areas that I talked about. And, you know, I think that a lot of us find ways of avoiding that. We can find ways, even as leaders, even as experienced workers, to stay out of the thick of things, can't we? Some of us have found ways where we've found a safe place where we can just kind of float along, maybe get other people to do the work. There's ways we can find to avoid dealing with that. And we have to admit, we have to just come to the frank conclusion that this is just not the walk of faith. This is not walking in faith in God. It's not. And I completely understand why we do that. We feel scared. We feel intimidated at what God has before us. And that's okay. I think that's why he makes the comment in this passage, stand back from the ark. Why? You've not been this way before. You don't know what you're doing. And I think God understands that many of the things that you are facing right now in your life and in your home church, you haven't been this way before. This is new ground that God is asking you to cover, and it's natural to feel an amount of fear and intimidation about that, to want to shy away from that. And yet, God calls you forward. These are the decisions that separate the mediocre from the dynamic Christian life, from the unfruitful and the fruitful. This is where it's at, these decisions. We've got to respond. And so in consecration, I think there's two crucial considerations that we have to make then in that light. And the first one is this, that God goes before us. We have to reflect on the fact that God goes before us, just as he did with the children of Israel. He's not like the other deities who sent the armies across to secure the land, make sure everything was safe, and then the idol would come over, and then the God would come over. Not so with Yahweh. He says, you stay back here. I'm going across. I'll let you know when it's okay. He goes before us. He says, stand back. I will lead. God goes before. And we have to realize then that the question before you right now is not, can you handle the situation before you? That's not what God's asking. The question before us is, do you believe God is mighty enough to handle the situation before you? Is God enough? We think about the Israelites as they stood there. Oh God, what about Jericho? You want us to cross this river? Look at this city right in our path. What are we going to do about that? And God says, I will take care of it. But how? There's no way. They have walls. They have an army. We're wandering nomads. And they were right to a strictly human perspective. As they sat there in their tents that night thinking this over, they had to think, we can't figure it out. There's no way we can match up. They were right about that. And yet God's response is, you don't need to know how. All you need to know is me. All you need to know is me. But what about the giants? I'm going to take care of it. What about the food? I will teach you. I will make the land fruitful. I will carry you along. This is where our confidence comes then. Not from a sense of feeling like we can handle it, like we can handle the issues in our home church. Not from there. But from the assurance that God in His grace will bless you. God, based on His gracious love for you, will support you. He will be with you. He will go before you. And there will be joy in this if we follow Him. There will be suffering. There will be hardship, no doubt. But there will be joy. And He will bless us. And as that starts to dawn on us, the promises that God has, those fears begin to evaporate. And this is, of course, why God told them back in chapter 1. Let's look at what He says. He says, every place on which the sole of your foot treads, I have given it to you. Just as I spoke to Moses, no man will be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I've been with Moses, I will be with you. I will not fail you or forsake you. Be strong then and courageous, for you shall give this people possession of the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous. God says, I've taken care of it. I'm going before you. No man will be able to stand before you. I've already given you the land. I will be with you. I will not fail you. I will not forsake you. It's not going to be a situation where you get out there and you start looking around and all of a sudden, I'm gone. I will not forsake you. We are in this together. And I will be with you. That changes the situation, doesn't it? But notice, however, what He doesn't say in this passage. He doesn't say, I will make you courageous. He says, I will take care of everything. Now you be courageous. Stand up and let's move forward. Courage is our role. Take courage. I think it thrills the heart of God when He sees His children walking into the face of some of their most daunting fears simply because they know they trust Him so much. They believe in His love and in His grace. I think that thrills His heart to see that. What's the other option? If we're not going to be courageous, well, actually, that is the other consideration. What is the other option? As we stand in that point of decision, what is the other option that we have? You know, even with our lives, we've all been given so much time, so much money, so much everything, so many resources at our disposal to expend. You have to expend them during your life. What are you going to expend yourself for? What are we going to expend our lives for? For some of us, the decision He might be calling on us for is life commitment. Even as servant team members, maybe we need to commit our life to God and not let Him be just be a hobby anymore. Are we really going to expend our lives for wealth, for physical well-being, for all these other things? It's a waste. He calls on us to commit our lives to Him. And certainly, as we were talking about here, once we take the power of God into consideration, suddenly the choice looks very different. Okay, if it's true, God, that Jericho isn't a factor, that you're going to deal with them, I believe that. If it's true that the giants, you're going to deal with them, if all these things I don't need to really worry about, you will take care of, if I have your word on that, then what is the choice that's before us? Do I want a desert, or do I want a land flowing with milk and honey? Do I want to go back and wander without a home for years and years again? Or do I want a home, a place where I can sink my roots for generations? A beautiful home. Do I want manna every day? Or do I want those grapes? This was a great land that he was providing for them. Yes, they were going to have to learn to farm it, but it's a step of maturity, he was asking them, because the payoff is so good. Simply, do I want the old stuff? Do I want to retreat to the old? Or I do want the new clothes, the new life that God has for us in his promised land. And you know, I think it needs to be said that even if we shrink back and we cling to the old, isn't it interesting that God still cares for us? You know, in all those verses in the Old Testament when he reminds Israel, I cared for you in the wilderness. Yes, part of it is he's reminding them that he, in a desert, he cared for them. He fed them, all that. Yes. But also, he's reminding them of the fact that they chose against him. They walked away from this decision, and he still provided the manna. He still cared for them. And God's gracious. If we shrink back, if we fail, he's still going to provide for us. But we can't say it's going to be the same as if we move forward with him. We can't say that. Some of us have been letting our fears govern us. We've been living our lives trying to keep our anxieties, our fears just at a dull roar, finding a place where we can float along. And maybe God is calling on us this weekend to turn and to face up to it. Not on our own power, but to realize he has a plan. And he will give us victory in those areas if we trust him. This is the same choice Christ had to make in the Garden of Gethsemane, wasn't it? He consecrated himself there because he wrestled with God. Please take this cup from me. Please. But he comes around to, but not my will, but yours be done. And we're told in Hebrews chapter 12 that for the joy set before him, he endured the cross. He endured the cross. And so this is the first thing that we need to do, and we need to instruct others to do, is to consecrate themselves, to maybe to get alone for a while and to reflect upon the sovereignty of God and what he has before us. Very important. Secondly, we go on in verse 10. It says there that Joshua said to the people, that is, by this you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will assuredly dispossess from before you the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Hivite, the Perizzite, the Girgashite, the Amorite, the Jebusite, all those. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth is crossing over ahead of you into the Jordan. Now then, take for yourself 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one man for each tribe, and it shall come about that when the soles of the feet of the priests who carry the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off, and the waters which are flowing down from above shall stand up in one heap. So here we have the familiar old point, and yet one we need to hear again, that God calls on us then, once we have set our will, that we are going to follow God, to move forward and to get our feet wet. Isn't that interesting? You can imagine the thoughts of these priests as they're carrying the ark forward. And we, if you remember from your reading, the Jordan is at full flood stage at this point. It is a rushing torrent of a river. And as they move forward, you know, possibly they're thinking, okay, you know, as I get closer here, the waters are going to start to gurgle, and gradually we're going to start to see them split, or, you know, we're going to look up and in the sky there's going to be a big thumbs up or something like that. Not so. Not so. They move forward, they get to the point where their toes are getting wet as this water rushes by and nothing is happening. Very important point. There is absolutely no circumstantial, physical evidence given that that water was going to part. They had to step their feet down in there. Splash down in. I remember Dennis making a great point about this once, that he says, I think this really speaks to our fear of embarrassment. You know, imagine those priests, you know, sloshing down in there, yeah, and all of a sudden one just gets washed away, and the other one can't get his footing. He's like, oh, back it up, you know. People up in Jericho are laughing. We have that fear, don't we? That if I move forward, if I step out, I'm going to look like a fool. God is going to fail me. But the important thing is, that is not what happened, is it? That is not what happened. God said, I will not forsake you. And when they put their feet in, he did not. And it said the waters rolled back and stood up in a heap right there. He will be faithful to his word. I don't know who it was. It was either C.S. Lewis or Francis Schaeffer pointed out that really this life, in a unique way, is our only chance to live by faith. You know, someday we're going to see Christ face to face. Like it says in 1 Corinthians 13, you know, now we just see dimly. Soon we're going to see him face to face. We only know in part now, but then we're going to know fully. It almost be like we have Thomas's faith at that point, you know, where he saw Christ. Remember what Christ said to Thomas? Blessed are those who do not see and believe. That's you and me. He said, people who don't see and yet still put their faith, despite what their eyes are telling them, what their own intellect and their own perception of the situation is telling them, people who trust me in spite of that, they're blessed. They have a unique blessing. This is our only chance to live by faith, he says. So you've got to get your feet wet. God is not going to resolve the issues that face you until you wade in there, until you enter the fray, until you call the meeting, until you speak up with another brother or sister, whatever it is. It will not resolve itself until we step in and get our feet wet. A lot of us know what this is like simply with the area of teaching. You know, you teach a cell group or a home church. I never feel confident about a teaching before I get up and give it, including this one. You know, up until the moment where you step up, maybe you guys know what I'm talking about, you just feel like, you know, this outline makes no sense. This makes no sense. You start to get this paranoia that, you know, it's heresy or all these kind of things. And you have this sense that I'm going to get up there and nobody's going to understand it. I'm going to say something stupid. All these sorts of things. And so we turn, we pray. I pray, God, give me some assurance that you're going to use this. Give me something. And nothing except his word. The only thing the priest had, too. His word. My word will not go forth and return void. You have my word. And it's not until we step up and we open our mouths, it's not until we get our feet wet and move forward, that the power of God begins to move. And it will. It will. The question that I find constantly coming up in my mind over and over again is this, Tom, is this the line? Is this it? It seems like every believer gets to a point, God brings them along and they take steps of faith, but then they get to one point and it's too much. To trust God here, it's just too much to ask, too much for my ego, too much more on my schedule, whatever. But it's too much. And so we draw a line there and we write our name beside it, Tom Dixon. And we have to say that is as far as Tom Dixon went. Most believers come to that point. They come to that line. And as we stand there, we have to acknowledge everything that's gone before. God has been nothing but faithful. He has come through in every circumstance. Every time I've stepped forward, he has been faithful. I have no reason to distrust him. Why would I think he's not going to handle this? This is really what we're saying at that point. I do not believe God is big enough to handle this. I just don't believe. He will let me down if I step forward. He will. Or are we going to step forward? Is it going to be a Kadesh Barnea of sorts where we shrink back? Or is this situation going to be another Jordan River experience where it becomes a fresh proof of God's reality, His love, and His power in your life? It's a good question to ask. Am I at that line? Is this it? Is this the one that takes my faith out? Or not? Well, anyway, I think this has got to be one of the greatest moments in the nation of Israel's history. It's really got to be, you know, because one nation coming together, everybody consecrates themselves, agrees, and they all go across, don't they? There's not a division that breaks out. They all, united under God's will, move forward. Really unique. A national political entity functioning on a principle of faith in God. That's the way it should have been all along. That's what God wanted. It's very cool. And it's certainly interesting to reflect upon the situation of the priests here. You notice that they didn't just go in, get the water rolled back, and cross over. You remember from your reading, they stood in that riverbed until the entire nation, probably about 2 million people at this point, passed by. So they're standing there that whole time, I'm sure at times glancing upstream at this fomenting wall of water threatening to explode down upon them at any moment. They stood there in the shadow of that wall waiting for the people to cross. And I'm sure they encouraged them. Come on, hurry along. Come on. That's okay. In fact, I think in chapter 4 it says that many of the people hurried across, and that's all right. That's okay. They did it. But it is such a great picture for us, these guys, standing in the shadow of that wall of water, because they understood that was the safest place to be. Right next to the ark, right next to God. At that moment in the universe, that was the safest place to be. Right there. Now, I want to take a few moments and look at a couple specific cases of people who made that same decision to pass beneath that, in the shadow of that wall of water, who took that step of faith. The first one, of course, is Joshua. Joshua stepped across. And he may have had more at stake as he crossed that riverbed than anyone else, because he was now the leader. He was now responsible. He's responsible for leading a nation which we know was not easy to lead. Incredibly difficult. And not only that, but he was leading them right into the grasp of their enemies, into hardship. A stubborn, rebellious people, difficult to lead, and he was taking them into real danger. And not only that, but he also had huge shoes to fill, didn't he? Moses had just been set aside. Moses was not in the riverbed anymore. And now everybody used to look to Moses, and now they turn and they look to Joshua. Many of us can identify with Joshua then in that respect. Many of us who are stepping up into leadership and we've never led before. We've never been the ones to have to handle things, to have to produce or serve up the teachings, the word for the young believers in our group. To discern where the issues are in our group and to deal with them. Some of us have never had to do that. And now, people are turning and looking at us. Others of us maybe have lost the powerful personality. That there was a man or a woman in our group that everybody looked to and loved. They always had the timely word. They were always able to see their way through a situation, to really see what the real issue was. And now they're going the other way in the plant. And now people are looking for you to fill that role, to fill those shoes. I've been there. That's hard. That's really hard. Many of us know what this is like. I even think of old Jim Leffel there, who was asked last year to step up and regularly teach CTs. A gifted teacher. But who are people going to compare him with? Dennis and Gary, who have been doing that for decades, were gifted. And yet Jim did it, and he's been fantastic. God, he has. Many of us know what Joshua felt like then, stepping across. And so there's two lessons, I think, that we learn from Joshua here. And the first one is this. No leader is indispensable. No leader is indispensable. I find it amazing that God would set aside his man Moses, his friend, with all his experience and his wisdom at this crucial point, that he would set him aside and put in a new leader. Not if I was in charge. No way. I would have had Moses get him across the river, get a couple battles under the belt, and then say, okay, you take over from here. Something like that. But not God. Notice what he says to Joshua. Back in chapter 1, he says, no man will be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. I will not fail you or forsake you. Be strong and courageous, for you shall give this people possession of the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Such a comfort. What comforting words from God. We find then that God periodically makes a point of demonstrating that his work is not dependent on the great leader. He periodically makes a point of demonstrating to us that his work is not dependent on the great leader. Sometimes he exudes the new guy into that role. Some of us know what it's like to be exuded into a position of leadership where we feel like the mighty hand of God himself is at our back pushing us forward. Now is the time to lead. You're like, oh, no. But it's such a relief, actually, to know that it's not dependent on your personality. Not dependent on that. It's dependent on the fact that God is committed to you and he will work through you. It's such a relief. For those of us who tend to be a little more controlling, we need to understand that God can work through others. He can. Even if they don't fit the exact picture that you see as a leader, God can work. But especially for those of us who are new leaders, we simply need to understand the power of God. It is real. It is real. After all, Moses went through this so that you see as a leader, God can work. But especially for those of us who are new leaders, we simply need to understand the power of God. It is real. It is real. After all, Moses went through the same thing at the burning bush, didn't he? He didn't want to lead. He didn't feel adequate to lead. He gave all sorts of excuses, and yet God said, I will take care of everything. I'll give you Aaron. Don't worry about it, but go. Move forward. I have called you. And God has called you, brothers and sisters, into the position of leadership, the role that you have. Take heart in that. You didn't manipulate your way into the situation. God called you forward. Why? He knows you. He knows you with all your weaknesses. He knew what he was getting into. And yet he said, that's the person I want. So put your faith in that. If God has called me forward, he must know what he's doing. And I'll trust them. True leaders always face a moment of crisis in which they face their utter inadequacy. And yet at that moment have that dawning realization of the sovereignty and the care of God for them. So, yes, on the one hand, no leader is indispensable. But there's another truth that goes right hand in hand with this. That's this. No leader is replaceable. No leader is replaceable. God set aside Moses, and at the same time that the Bible affirms that God was going to be with Joshua just as he was with Moses, it also affirms there was never another one like Moses until Christ. But Israel never saw another man like Moses. Each of us is unique. God has given us each unique gifts. You know, you imagine if we lost a Gary DeLashman. Working in the yard and he falls in the chipper or something like that. It's gone. Maybe not like that. Maybe some other way. Sorry to be so macabre, but you know, we lose Gary. No leader is indispensable. The work here could go on. Others could rise to the occasion. The work in this fellowship could flourish. It could. I'm not saying it would, but it could. It could. But at the same time, we'd have to affirm we would never have Gary again. We could never replace him. His incredible ability to teach the word and divide it, to speak powerfully the truth of God. His dogged determination to follow God no matter what circumstance comes his way, like a steam engine, Gary just keeps plowing forward. Even just his, you know, the little things about him, his love for the weather and all that sort of thing. We wouldn't have another Gary. We wouldn't have that. And so in this sense, leaders are gifts from God. They're true gifts. There would be real loss there. There would be. And I bring this up because I think it's important for us to know, because we get into this discouragement of comparison, where we compare ourselves to these other leaders. We think we have to be the same way. Certainly, we should model their commitment to Christ, things about their walk with God, yes. But in terms of their personality, their gifting, God has gifted you uniquely. Look what Francis Schaeffer says. I think this is great. He says, "No man is indispensable, but every man is unique. Men are dispensable, but this does not mean that one man fills another man's place in the same way as a person would remove one concrete block and put another concrete block in its place. In the final analysis, nobody takes the place of anybody else. This is the wonder of personality and the wonder of God using personality in leadership." Again, God's called you for a reason. You've got unique gifts. You've got a personality that he can use. Let's not get into comparing ourselves. You're not going to replace that person. And so, again, with Joshua, we see that God is calling you and supporting you just as he was Joshua. Let's move forward. Then we come to the next crew that entered the riverbed that day. We assume that Joshua led the people over. And then we have the old Reubenites and the Gadites. We're told in Joshua chapter 4, "But the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh crossed over in battle array before the sons of Israel, just as Moses had spoken to them. About 40,000 equipped for war crossed for battle before the Lord to the desert plains of Jericho." All right, so you think, what's the point? So we've got the Reubenites and the Gadites going across. We have to know the context to understand what's going on here. And I actually think that there is a lesson for us here. But the story is that the Reubenites or the Gadites, the half-tribe of Manasseh, if you would read in Numbers chapter 32, is where this story comes from. But they came to the east side of the Jordan after they had defeated Sihon and Og. And on the east side of the Jordan, where the nation of Israel was camped, they looked around and they realized this is good land. And they had livestock and they were shepherds, and it was perfect for that. And so they decided, we just want to stay here. This is just what we want. So they go to Moses, and they say, this is good enough. We would like this land. And it's real interesting because Moses gets fired up because he thinks this is Kadesh happening all over again. He thinks they don't want to cross, and they're going to end up discouraging the rest of the people from doing it. So he gets kind of fired up. But they talk, and they work out a deal. And Moses puts him to a test. And he says, okay, you can have this land, but you have to agree that you will send your fighting men, your men, across with the rest of the tribes, and you will fight with them, alongside with them. In fact, what we find in the book of Joshua is that they led the nation into battle, just as they were doing here. And they fought alongside their fellow Israelites for 7 years, roughly, until every other tribe was settled, and then they could go back. That was the deal. And they did it. And so as they cross the Jordan, they're leaving behind the children, their wives, their possessions, back there. I'm sure there was some anxiety about that. Probably they left, you know, a small fighting force to help protect them, but certainly the bulk of their strength was going over with the rest of the nation. Moses asked them, shall you sit here while all your brothers go to war? No. Cross over. And so as they stepped across, they were taking a step in faith that God not only was going to protect them as they went out and fought, but that he was also going to protect things back home in their territory, that he was going to take care of things, that he was going to watch over them. I really respect these guys. They could have just snuggled up in their cozy homes and wished the rest good luck. But they didn't. They fought alongside him. And so I think there's a word of warning or caution for us here, since we're a home group-based fellowship, a group of semi-autonomous groups that function around and have many concerns within our groups, a lot of concerns within each home church that occupy our minds, that we're anxious about, that we work to meet. And yet what we find is that God also calls us periodically in many ways to serve outside of that, to serve the rest of the fellowship, and even to serve the greater universal body of Christ by sending out missionaries. And this is hard, isn't it? You know, you've got a couple in your group, and you think, okay, if we cut them loose for the mission field, we're going to hold up our plant. It's going to cause all sorts of problems. If we send these workers to junior high ministry, it's going to slow us down. Oasis, there's all these areas, and it's hard, isn't it? But this is a word of warning, I guess, and I think this is where they're a great example for us, is that if God is calling us forward to that, He'll help take care of the things at home, too. The word we use when we discuss it is in eldership meetings is provincialism. This idea that we don't want to see people get so focused on their tribe and their world that they forget what God is doing outside of that. And we need to lean against this. Again, this is not something that we feel like we are failing at. In fact, we feel like we're doing really well. We think of the junior high adopt-a-cell program, the high school adopt-a-cell program last year. People really have answered the bell. It's been great. We have received so much help, and we're so thankful for that. Missionaries are going out, so we are doing the job, but we feel like we periodically need to sound that bell, that, man, let's keep trusting God in this area. When we see that CT attendance sags way behind home group attendance, it sometimes makes you wonder, are people just not valuing the CT, the work that goes on there? I don't know. It's just a question I think we have to ask. But I think in that vein, again, this is a great example for us. I know in the college group, I've been down there, it's real easy to view what's going on in the rest of the church as relatively unimportant. You know, some of the younger believers tend to kind of scoff at all the big budget and all the building plans and the kids and the programs and all that. It's easy to get into that. Adult groups, maybe, you know, we look at somebody who goes off and does junior high ministry and, you know, you don't see what they do. You don't see the fruit. They just run around with kids all the time. And you just wonder, well, you know, if they would weigh in with us, so much more could be done. It's natural to feel that way. But we have to understand there's a time to circle the wagons. There certainly is times in our home groups when we do need to get everybody focused on what's going on. But by and large, we need to have a category for letting the Lord draw people away in different ways to serve in different parts of the church. I mean, what's the choice we have, again? Are we going to have our sixth grade son or daughter just have a big 200-person junior high meeting once a week and that's it? That is all the spiritual input they get? Don't we want an older Christian brother or sister meeting with them, at least in a small group, in a cell group, on a weekly basis where they get to know them, they can answer their questions? Oh, yeah, we've got to do that. We've got to do that. There's no other option. So we just got to keep moving forward as we have. Like I've said, we've done a great job. And there's some great examples. We're going to bring up the Oatneys here in a little while. They've done a great job. I think of the Flores Church. They open their home up for a high school home church once a week, which is sacrificial. They do it every week in addition to what they do in their own home group. And we had an outreach event in the high school group this year where we invited out parents of non-Xenos students who were non-believers. And the Flores group were everywhere, making desserts, setting tables. They did it all. It was so sweet to get their help for that. And it was dynamic. We had hundreds of people. And I forget what it was. I think it was between a third and a half of the people that showed up were non-Xenos parents, most of whom were non-believers. It's great. So we're really grateful for this. The last example, then, is the families. Oh, yeah. Then the rest of the nation crossed over, family by family, tribe by tribe. And this is something that really struck me a year or so ago when I was happened to be reading through this. That is, you know, we imagine the plight of a father and mother standing there, their kids, their possessions, their livestock, on the banks of the Jordan. They look across. Again, they see Jericho. They see the danger. They see this wall of water pushed back, and they're asked to move forward. it really makes you wonder. I often think, okay, if Xenos Christian Fellowship, if the Xenoids were on the banks of that Jordan that day, what would have happened? Would it be the same story? Maybe. But, you know, one thing that comes to mind is I wonder if there would have been a movement among us to, you know, gather up all the kids and to take them upriver to a safe place to cross and to, you know, get them across with you know, some of the armed men around them, get them across safely, and the men of the household would cross over and express their faith in God, and they would hook up with the kids on the other side. I wonder. But the interesting thing to note is that's not what God asked of them, is it? He said, the kids go in. The elderly go in. You know, again, I've thought about that. What if I were there, you know, as a, let's say, a single college student? I think about that. I think, you know, I think I could have done that. I think I could have walked across. That's exciting. Put your faith in God like that. But then when you stand there with a three-year-old girl in one hand, it's a different picture, isn't it? And these people did it. They took their kids, their possessions, everything right under the shadow of that wall of water. I think that's so cool. Why? Because they understood what I said earlier. The safest place for their kids to be was right next to God. That's the safest place to be. We should let that sink in. It raises a lot of questions in my mind about the values that I have, the values I'm going to raise my family with. Because it's going to look odd. It certainly looked odd to the people looking on there in Jericho what they were doing. You know, which, there's nothing wrong with your kids getting good grades. But my question is one of priority. Which is going to bother us more? If my kids don't grow up and they're not that polite and they don't get good grades, or if they're just not that excited about the things of God? Which one of those is really going to bother me more? It's so important that they get raised in a way where they understand they've got to be close to God. This is so crucial. This is a great thing for them to see, this step of faith, even the kids. And it seems, as we read this, the rest of the book of Joshua, that generation that went across the river did all right. It said it's the next generation that came along that forgot. And to a great extent, it was their fault too. Gary's going to get into this more tomorrow, the compromise that settled in. So I'm not going to get into it all that much. But I just think it's so important also to realize that the unbelieving generation that turned back, that was that one of the reasons they cited. Our kids, our wives will be cut to ribbons. Let's go back to Egypt. God says the kids go in the river. Not because he doesn't care about them, the exact opposite. Because that's the safest place for us to be, is right with God in the middle of his will. The last principle then is this, that we remember. We consecrate ourselves, we get our feet wet, and then once we've seen what God has done, we remember what he's done. We remember what he's done. So important. This is where we get in Joshua 4. He says those 12 stones which they had taken up from the Jordan, Joshua set up at Gilgal. And he said to the sons of Israel, when your children ask their fathers in a time to come, saying, what are these stones? Then you shall inform your children, saying, Israel crossed this Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan before you until you had crossed, just as the Lord your God had done to the Red Sea, which he dried up before us until we had crossed, that all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, so that you may fear the Lord your God forever. So as you know, Joshua, after they had crossed, sets up two memorials. He has the men go in and out of the middle of the Jordan River's riverbed, pull out 12 stones, and he set them up at Gilgal, but he also set one right in the middle of the Jordan River, so that when it washed back over, here's this memorial out in the middle of the river. People walk by, how did that get there? Let me tell you. And as he says, the reason was because it was so important for people to remember what God had done. Why? Because people forget. And we forget so easily how faithful God really has been to us. how powerful he's really worked in our lives. He said the thing that you are to do is to bring your children to this memorial. And as you stand there and explain what each of these 12 stones means, and you look down at the Jordan, tell them what happened. Explain how the priests walked in. Tell them where you crossed. He says, tell them the whole story in detail to build their faith. And it was also, as he says, a testimony to the other nations, because they knew what happened. Jericho knew what happened here. In fact, we're told in chapter 5 that the mere fact of them crossing over the Jordan took the heart out of them. The battle was over at that point. It said that their hearts melted within them. Their act of faith, they thought that the Jordan River was going to protect them. And God said, here we come. Their hearts melted. So it was certainly a testimony to the others around there. But the point is this, that we need to actively remember what God has done in our lives. There's a pattern that I see in my life, and it's talked about here in Hosea chapter 13, where God says, I cared for you in the wilderness, in the land of drought. But as they had their pasture, they became satisfied, and being satisfied, their heart became proud, therefore they forgot me. I met their needs. They stepped forward in faith, and I came through for them. And things got so good for them that they forgot me. Let's not forget what the Lord has done in our life. Psalm 103 is another one where he goes through and he lists out all the things that God has done. He heals all your diseases. He redeems your life from the pit. He separated your sins as far as the east is from the west. He has compassion on you. On and on and on it goes. And it says one thing to us. It says, forget none of his benefits. Don't forget. And we forget so easily, not only what he's done in our life, but what he's done in our fellowship also. What he's done in our churches. Harvest meetings are a great opportunity to practice this. And I think baptisms really are too. You walk away from there kind of amazed at what God's been able to do. So let's actively make a point of remembering what God has done in our lives. All right. I'm going to draw the line right there. That's good enough. And Dennis will pick it up tomorrow. Why don't we... Cool. Very cool. Lord, just help us to take new ground this year, that we will, as committed brothers and sisters, together commit to move forward. Again, that's so striking, this picture, that there wasn't one family that didn't. They all did it. So cool. Pray that we can be like that as your church, too, and that we'll see you do great things through us. In your name, amen.